Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain the cultural
provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
Here are the WGXC headlines. Another mass shooting on February 17th, as six people were shot dead in a small town in rural Mississippi near the Tennessee state line. Five former Memphis police officers pleaded not guilty February 17th to second-degree murder and other charges
18 known
in the violent arrest and death of Tyree Nichols, with his mother saying afterwards that none of them would look
Alan,
her in
I
the eye.
I just got word from the ratings group
on February 16th,
that we are the number
Pennsylvania
one
Senator John Fetterman, Democrat who was elected to the Senate after a bruising campaign during which he suffered a stroke.
We are the number
checked
one.
Himself into
you
a hospital
we get
for
more
clinical
listeners
depression.
Than anyone else?
Statements
that's
from Fetterman's right? staff said he had experienced depression on and off in his life, that's but it only becomes...
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, if I'm not mistaken, you are listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Well, good night, Norman. Broadcasting to you live from beautiful downtown Hudson, New York, on WGXC 90.7 FM, Hudson Community Radio, and WGXC.org, the World Wide Web. Background, you'll probably hear Margot or not. This morning, February 20th, 2023, from the Book of the Unknown, Tales of the 36th. By Jonathan Cates. Zion, the profane. Let me clean my throat. Zion the prophet. Zion never asked to be the Messiah. Daughter of the village apothecary, a widower named Menashe. She already had plenty of responsibility for a 13-year-old girl. For example, she had to wake up every morning at dawn to dust and sweep her father's little shop. And in the afternoon, while he napped, she had to stand on tiptoe at the counter, taking orders. Zion was a good girl. She didn't complain, even when her father sent her to houses where boys tormented her with unsolicited kisses and taunted her for spurning their advances with accusations that she and her papa were too affectionate. She didn't understand quite what they meant, but she knew that she loved him alone in the world and would do anything at all for his sake, as he had done everything for her. She intended to be his helpmeet forever, as young girls will, and her efforts played no small part in the prosperity of his shop. His prescriptions were as effective as could be expected, never deadly, yet it was her light step as she delivered those medications, her still voice and gentle smile that nursed folks. Nobody liked to pass a whole winter without a head cold. And in summer, when she wore flowers in her hair, there was a veritable epidemic of hay fever. Illness lost its stigma in the village on account of young Zion. People even looked forward to new ailments, as a garment longs for the pain. How else to explain the town's attitude toward rumors of a great plague sweeping the countryside? At first, the news came from shiftless old catters, flea-bitten beggars peddling rat-eaten clothes swindled from the dead. They swore that they'd seen whole cities extinguished in a breath, and had endured the crush, escaped the Holocaust, only because death prefers to embrace fresh youth. Ordinarily, local rowdies would have ousted these filthy old men with sticks and stones, and the village aldermen would have taken the additional precaution of barring the town's gates, but the reputation of Menashe the apothecary made folks confident that there was nothing to worry about, and perhaps a visit from Zion to anticipate. Even the initial influx of refugee families from the east the following day merely made villagers wonder why every couldn't have a good druggist with a pretty daughter to assuage their cares. Only Menashe was distraught. He cautioned that his medications could not cure a plague, but folks were too keenly occupied watching refugees arrive and die to hear what he had to say. And then it was too late. An 18-year-old peasant named Bible was the first villager to complain. He claimed that a devil sat on his chest while he slept, stealing his breath. His brothers wanted to know what the Dybbuk looked like, but he didn't know because the creature vanished the moment he awoke. After a few days, the demon came up with a cleverer idea. Instead of floating off at dawn, devils naturally lose their mortal weight in daylight. The beast climbed down inside Fibon's lung. There it was always dark. The night never ended, and Fibon, become but a second skin for the demon, always slept. Unable to arouse him with pinpricks or lamp burns, his brothers visited the apothecary. Menashe's shop was already crowded with relatives of folks who, while not yet as ill as poor Fibel, already couldn't breathe in their sleep. They begged the druggist for an elixir that would lift this evil. They reached out hands heavy with silver, but he simply stood behind his counter, arms in the air. listened to the commotion. She'd never heard such noise in the shop, but strangest to her of all sounds was the voice of her own father. In her 13 years, she hadn't once heard him shout or turn someone down. After several hours, Menashe cleared out his shop. He came up to take a nap. Zion wished to ask him many questions, but her fear that he'd yell at her as he shouted at his patients made her quiet. She kept out of his way. From the corner, she watched him fall his body into bed. He called her over. Shutting his eyes, he murmured that she didn't need to tend the shop, as he'd already locked it up. Then he folded his hands over his belly and fell into a heavy sleep. After a while, Zion grew tired of being idle. Intending to sweep the floors, she wandered downstairs, where she saw some men at the door. She let them in. Bible's three brothers crowded around her, all at once trying to explain what was the matter. Bible will die if the devil inside him isn't doused. I'm sure my father can fix a tonic. I'll bring it tonight. There's no money for anything fancy. I'll tell Papa not to make you pay. He'll understand. He's good that way. She sent them home and started to clean, pleased to be doing more than was expected of her. She dusted the sills and was about to polish the countertop when her father came to her. Were those men's voices I heard? Bible's brothers were here. He needs a tonic to get the devil out of him. It isn't a Dybbuk, Zion. It's a plague. Whatever it is, Bible needs some medicine. I promised to bring a draft to him tonight. You don't understand. I closed the shop for a reason. I haven't got a remedy for Bible. I can't make one. Because of his money? Stupid girl, listen to me. A plague is deadly. I have a cure for nobody. Papa, you can do anything. You're an apothecary. Why are you yelling at me? He shook his head and led her up a ladder to the attic. She had never been there before, amid his bottled secrets, shelved alphabetically according to arcane names pronounced by no one since the fall from Eden. Ancient roots and pollen smuggled from that model garden into the mortal world. Like every apothecary, Zion's father trafficked in sacred contraband, distillations of eternity that, administered in the right combination and quantity, were said to lend the body grace with which to clear the evils of disease. But that, drunken gratuitously, might disturb the soul of flesh. Menashe watched his daughter peer into his stone crucible, tap on the copper basin of his still, lift the heavy bronze pestle from its mortar, and set it down again. When at last she'd satisfied her curiosity and could appreciate what he did, he told her that nothing she saw there, neither equipment nor stock, made the least medicinal difference. Naturally, the girl was perplexed. Was this not his only laboratory? Was there another ladder yet to climb? Were there attics and ladders stacked invisible except from within all the way to the heavens? She wondered if her father might be more than just a druggist, but before she could inquire, Menashe had uncorked one of the priceless powdered mysteries on his shelf and held it out to her. Confection of sugar, he said, and when she didn't believe him, he had her taste for herself. With the utmost care, she pointed a slender finger into the powder and touched it to her tongue. The uncut sweetness burned. Before she could pose the question, he let his daughter know the whole formula. He said that the antidote to an illness wasn't the product of a laboratory, nor did it grow in a garden. It came from within the patient. The active ingredient, so to speak, was hope. If folks believed that his pills and tonics worked miracles, they sometimes indirectly did, more often than the harsh chemicals with which city doctors routinely massacre the sick. The city doctors claimed to practice science, but Menashe had studied enough to know what they didn't and to acknowledge what they wouldn't. He said that given a chance, the body was a finer apothecary than the most learned chemist, but that people place their their faith elsewhere in elixirs. The elixirs. His non-toxic pills and tonics simply concentrated folks' faith, the belief that they were entitled to another draught of life, and directed it back inside where it belonged. Zion took in her father's words and knew that he was wise. Only one matter. If it's that simple, why can't I just bring 5 ml of tincture of sugar water? If he thinks it's a remedy. The body's a good apothecary, Zion, but a plague cannot be cured. 5 ml won't survive. Everyone who catches it will die. If I waste my reputation on hopeless cases, my medicines won't be as potent against lesser disease. Be practical and don't go outside or let anyone in. The plague will pass in a few weeks, but for now, there's no knowing who's sick. 5 ml's brothers were preparing for another all-night vigil, loading the hearth with coal, when the apothecary's daughter arrived at their hovel. In her hushed voice, she asked if the patient was still alive. They pointed to his bed by the fire. She smiled. She asked to be left alone with him, and because the estimable Menashe was her father, they went off to sleep in the hayloft. The girl was gone before dawn. 5 ml's brothers didn't see her leave. They gathered around him. One of them leaned on his chest to feel if he was breathing. He gasped, sighed. He opened his eyes. He asked for Zion. They didn't know what to tell him. I asked her to marry me. She wouldn't do it. Because you're dying, 5 ml. Not anymore. Do I seem sick still? While 5 ml hardly looked prepared to plow a field, his brothers had to admit that even his ability to talk bespoke progress. They wanted to know which of Menashe's drugs the girl had given him. He swore that she had brought none, yet he couldn't say what she'd done to bring about his unexpected recovery. He could recollect only that she'd been clutching his hands for a long time and talking to him, whisperingly, when the demon in his chest released him, or perhaps he released the demon. But what was she saying? Was she praying? Did she cast a spell? I don't know what she told me, but there was sense in her murmuring, and something more, a singing from elsewhere. I was scared to open my eyes, that she'd disappear forever. I held her hands tight. I looked at her. It was like staring into a sunrise. I asked her to marry me, but I knew she wouldn't. She isn't one of us. His brothers weren't sure exactly what he meant by that, but they knew that he was right, because her voice scarcely stirred the air when she spoke, and her feet barely touched the earth where she walked. She had almost the substance of light. Several days passed. As 5 ml convalesced, other folks got worse. The plague threatened to suffocate whole families. Given another week, the town itself might have ceased to breathe had 5 ml's brothers not confided to a grain merchant whose wife lay ill, Zion's extraordinary visitation. But Menashe himself pronounced that there's no earthly remedy. He closed up shop. It wasn't one of his drugs that made 5 ml better. It's Zion herself. You see, she isn't one of us. On his way to fetch her, the grain merchant repeated what he'd heard to the miller, whose employees were too sick to work, and the miller mentioned it to the sawyer, and the cooper's wife, and several journeyman carpenters, and soon the whole town shared the same secret. A crowd swelled around the apothecary's door. Menashe had spent the past couple of days securing his building against the incurable sickness and those who carried it. He'd boarded over the windows and doors of his shop with lumber, and had little Zion climb up into the chimney flue to pack it tight with rags. Then he'd sent her down to the basement to see what provisions they had, and what she could make from them in days and weeks to come. It was while she was down there that Menashe heard the clamor outdoors, louder than it had been in days since the first tremor of the plague. For a moment he listened, but he didn't hear people shouting his name. They were calling for Zion, Menashe peered through the one attic window he hadn't yet boarded and sealed. He saw burghers and tradesmen and peasants, many of whom carried saws and axes in their hands. He opened the casement and leaned out over the sill.
What do you want from me? I've told you this plague is deadly. I have no cure.
We want your daughter.
You want to kill her?
We wanted to save us, Menashe.
Has the plague made you crazy? She's just a little girl.
She revived Bible.
She did it. She couldn't.
Zion isn't of this world. Menashe hurried down to the cellar. He grabbed his daughter and demanded to know what she'd done. She told him that she'd tallied up all the carrots and beets, but not yet the onions.
That's not what I mean. There are people outside saying you revived Bible.
Is he really feeling better?
Is Bible your lover? I ordered you not to go outdoors.
I haven't been out in days, Papa. I love only you. You taught me to care for others. How could I be true to you and let Bible suffer?
You stole my medicines. You faked my prescriptions.
I gave him no pills. I only stood by him a while. I held his hands in case he was in pain. I told him not to place such faith in demons. I said that I was there for him. I said that I had hope and asked him if he'd believe in me. Then I was going to try to explain about the body being an apothecary so he wouldn't feel bad, that I hadn't brought him drugs. But he interrupted by proposing marriage to me.
And you accepted?
Papa.
Do you have any idea what you've done, Zion? Can you even try to understand? Folks think you're some kind of messiah.
The girl couldn't tell if he was proud or disgusted or simply incredulous. In silence, he led her to the attic and pointed her to the window. More people had gathered below, and when they saw her, their voices lifted up on her name in sound and soared. Zion looked at her father and said she had to go to them. Menashe saw that it was true. If she didn't, they'd tear the house down. He turned away and let her leave him.
Sorry, just need a little drink of tea there.
For 7 days and nights, Zion did not sleep. Straight through the Sabbath she worked, tending the sick, holding their hands and murmuring her hope, insisting that they could get better, begging them to believe in her. They did, one after another. They believed that this lightning girl in long golden braids and white gossamer slip was the Savior, and one after another, they were healed by her. Of course, religious authorities were skeptical. The head rabbi and disputed leader of the community several times sent his beetle to seize her in order that there might be a proper inquisition regarding her irregular behavior. But the people wouldn't let her go. Then the old rabbi got ill. He was put to bed by his wife, a Zoptic woman half his age who all but breathed for him as he lay dying. At last she called for the beetle. Leading him into a room where nobody would hear, she asked the man to tell Zion that the rabbi needed her. The beetle had no difficulty locating the girl. Even from the steps of the shul, he could see the crowd of tradesmen and farmers surrounding the shack where she was reviving a stricken beggar. Having one and all pledged themselves to her, they called themselves her followers, despite her efforts to send them away, and also considered themselves her protectors, earthly guardians of the miracle that had saved them and their families. They halted the beetle as he approached. He tried to explain why he'd come, how it wasn't the same as the last time, but they shouted him down. Zion emerged into the commotion. She asked what was wrong. The beetle held up a hand and called out to her. Bible and his brothers knocked him over. The mob prepared to lynch him. closed in on their victim, they found that they were facing Zayed. She was standing over the rabbi's man. She wouldn't move until the mob lost its will to be woman. Then she knelt down and let the beetle speak. He repeated what the rabbi's wife had said to him and implored her, on his own behalf as well, to save the holy man. She took a deep breath. She vowed to do what she could, and against the advice of her self-appointed disciples, who predicted that it was a trap, accompanied the beetle to the rabbi's private quarters behind the shul. Several feverish acolytes, men with eager beards, were praying there, but stopped short when they saw Zion standing radiant at the door. Into the sudden silence rose the rabbi's wife, embracing the girl and saying loud enough for all to hear that she believed in her. Then she brought Zion to the bed where the rabbi lay sleeping, and chasing away the acolytes like vermin, left the two of them alone. For the first time, Zion faced the great man unseparated by the distance of ritual, the ordained space between altar and balcony. Up close, he appeared more ancient than the patriarchs. Had she not seen him leading the town in worship just a few weeks before, she'd have believed that he'd been dug from the ground like an antediluvian fossil. His skin was the cast of dust, his flesh as cold as clay. She clasped his hands anyway, and kneeling over him, laid her head on his chest. Her words came unprepared, and her mouth, the language softened, melting into songs she couldn't comprehend. The sick man began to hum. Zion lifted her head. Her lips were no longer moving. It was always this way when her work was done. Her song was being sung by him. The rabbi opened an eye and regarded her. How do you know these words, child of Menashe? I don't know them, Rabbi. They just come to me. You don't know them? They aren't known to me either. But when you chant them, they must be sacred. They come to me when I heal someone. Folks live when they accept my words as their own. You speak this way to a rabbi? I suppose that you have the right. But please answer me this. Why does the Savior come here in the body of a girl? With all due respect, Rabbi, I don't think I'm a Savior. I'm just good at letting people get better. You are the Messiah, then. This is how you test us. You come without priestly lineage or learning, and in the flesh of the flawed sex. I'd have ordered you dead for sacrilege. You choose to revive me. What is your reason, Zayed? Won't you please tell me? He closed his eyes while he spoke to hold in the emotion. When he opened them to look at her again, the little girl had fallen asleep, folded up at his feet. It is said that the Messiah has been here before, more times than any mortal can imagine. Every day, the Messiah comes and goes again, and always will, until the world is fit for redemption. This phenomenon is not arcane. It has been observed by everyone who has witnessed a sunrise. When the Messiah's heavenly robe drapes the earthly threshold, or seen a sunset as the last vestiges pass, haltingly overhead. As Zion's name became known across the land, people observed that the sky was different. Dusk wasn't as vivid with color as they remembered, nor was dawn as intense. A cosmic change had taken place. Folks no longer looked up for grace, but began to search in their own midst. They were looking for a girl with golden braids and a gossamer slip. They were looking for a girl whose feet didn't touch the earth and whose voice didn't stir the air. Synagogues and yeshivas Shiva said Don Boy is imploring her to pass through this village or that city, for every place touched by plague suffers in myriad ways. Zion didn't want to go. Already she hadn't seen her father in many days, and with the pestilence exorcised at last, she knew that he'd soon be needing her in his shop to sweep the floors and deliver balms for ordinary aches and pains. Yet when she told the rabbi this, he demanded to know what business the Messiah had pushing a mop. He was willing to accept that the Savior had breasts, but wasn't it a bit much for her to test folks' faith by keeping house for misanthropic Menashe while the whole world struggled? Uncertain as she was that she was who he believed her to be, she had to admit that on the chance that he was right, she was wrong to behave so selfishly. Late at night, while her disciples slept, she left. In the first village she reached, everyone was mourning the dead. That's all they did, day and night, since the plague had churlishly taken away parents and children and sisters and brothers and wives and husbands and lovers and friends, leaving the lives of those who remained desperately incomplete. Rain was falling when Zion arrived, so much that the streets were flooded. Yet as soon as she spoke, scores of people came outside, arms outstretched, to greet her through their tears. While ceaseless hours of sailing sorrow had washed away their vision, a mercy for those who no longer had family to see, her unwavering voice told them that the Messiah was in their midst to answer their prayers by ending their anguish. They wanted to bring her into the great hall where they prepared a banquet with the last of their harvest, but she declined. For a while she stood silent and still in the town square. Rain flowed through her cotton frock and down her pale skin as she waited until everyone was quiet. And a voice came to her. She asked if folks didn't notice the water pouring down from the sky. They did, and again urged her to come inside. She shook her head, and then, because they were blind, she said, "Don't you people know what it is, this storm above, and why it won't end? Don't you recognize the cry of your dead?"
"What do they got to be so upset about?"
"They're mourning."
"Mourning who?"
"Mourning all of you."
"But we're still alive."
"You don't look it from their point of view. You don't farm. You don't trade. Today is one of your festivals, but you don't dance or feast. The dead are gone and cannot return. How can they know if you live, that all is not lost, when you pass your lives in secret? If you want this downpour to stop, be done with your own tears first." She led them to their great hall. The banquet began. Hesitantly at first, folks drank and ate. Timidly at first, they sang and danced. Gradually, their revelry filled the night, poured over into the new day. In sunlight, they found that they could see again. They saw that there was no more rain. They looked for Zion, Savior of the living and dead. They searched everywhere for a girl with golden hair, but their Messiah, good work done, was gone. She arrived that day in a city where everyone constantly fought. They'd been warring ever since the plague had decimated their population, taking away the powerful and rich, and leaving a wealth of opportunity for those who endured, and with it, an epidemic of greed. Folks didn't pick up on Zion right away. Incessant bickering had deafened them. But from the moment that she was noticed, every man and woman demanded a private appointment. Each claimed personally to have invited her to the city in order that she might resolve their conflict before the shouting crumbled buildings. Beholden to faithful as a king, beholden to her as beholden to her faithful as a king is to his subjects. She did as she was bidden. She met with each person alone, and by everyone was told why opportunity couldn't be shared by the many, and what uniquely gave him or her, and not another soul, exclusive claim to the chance at hand. She listened with sympathy, and was unsettled to find that everyone was in agreement. Were the men and women correct? One and all, that chance didn't divide evenly, and opportunity, unless exploited individually, was just an empty promise. Wise Menashe would have known the answer, but of course Zion couldn't rely on her father anymore. The Messiah is sui generis. She straightened her shoulders, took a breath, and as ever, let the words swell within her. "You're right," she told each claimant, slowly, so her lips could be read. "But the opportunity is not yours to take."
Whose is it, then?
You must listen. It belongs to the first person whose words you hear. Folks shut their mouths after that. They cleaned their ears. There were advantages to be had simply by knowing who'd be chosen. Opportunity with an occasion, like the seeds inside an orange. And so it came to pass, after many months of quiet calm, that people heard again. Yet it didn't happen all at once, to the sound of a single voice. On the contrary, each person heard opportunity in somebody different. Everyone was chosen by someone else. Epidemic greed gave way to contagious cooperation. They rebuilt the city they built to honor Zion. By then she was long gone. She had been to 100 cities and towns. Folks reported miracles wherever her gaze fell. Her voice made plague-ruined villages flourish. Old ghosts were vanquished. Mothers had new children. People sought to worship Zion, and she permitted it, as long as it was done by grazing livestock or tilling the soil. Some grumbled that such profane activities had nothing to do with her eternal glory. Patiently, she reminded them that the world was the Messiah's twin, born of the same creation, and to treat either well was to honor the other. They did what she asked. They tended the earth. And when they prospered, they knew that Zion had blessed them in turn. One day, Menashe fell ill. Several years had passed since he'd last seen Zion, and the burden of running his shop had become wholly his own. They'd not been easy years. Folks had forgiven his churlishness during the pestilence only because the Messiah was, at least according to birth records, his own daughter. Even so, he sold far fewer elixirs than before. For the state of his business, he'd a bitter diagnosis from which he drew a sort of long-suffering comfort. Zion's little savior shtick had cured the land of hypochondria, patron ailment of his trade, by drugging people stilly with hope. Abandoned by his prodigal daughter, unable to afford help, he had to go out an old man in the chill of winter, peddling balms no one wanted anymore. He caught cold. He took to bed. He could have no medicine. Drugs were as false to him as I am. On the third day of Menashe's illness, the old rabbi came to his house. The apothecary was sleeping and couldn't be roused. The rabbi tried to recollect the benediction that Zion had given when he'd been sick, words as certain yet unfamiliar to him as his own birth. How could a scholar who was able to recite the entire Kabbalah not retain those few simple sounds? And why did the effort to remember them make him forget, for a trembling moment, even how to breathe? If he kept up the attempt, he knew he'd be lost to it. Forgetting birth is the price of life. Were it not forgotten, nothing else would make an impression. He surrendered. Instead of playing prophet, he wrote a letter imploring Zion, wherever in the world she was, to come home before her father, the one who had raised her, was dead and gone. He copied his missive 10 times and sent it to 10 other rabbis. He requested that each do the same. Then he returned to Menashe and waited while his words radiated across the continent. There wasn't yet any snow on the ground that winter, but within days the countryside was white with paper. Whole forests fell as letters begat letters, cascading from town to town, touching down in urgent flurries, rising up in a storm front. Zion had been in the same village for several days, the longest she spent in one place since she began her sojourn. The town wasn't especially sick or damaged, in want of complicated miracles, and she might not have spent a single night there were it not for a man she'd seen on the street and been unable to forget. He was a peddler, young yet well-worn like his old copper wares, a wanderer like she'd become, except that, while she was celebrated by folks who had yet to meet her, he was anonymous, even among people to whom he was familiar. Diane could not stop looking at him. She wondered if she'd met him before, if she'd saved him and was drawn to him protectively as mother to son. She wondered if she was somehow related to him, if they shared the same blood, a continent apart, as distant cousins. She wondered 100 wonders, but nothing she had known or even imagined could explain the intensity of his presence, his absolute singularity in a marketplace crowded with men and donkeys. A glimpse of him made her lose sight of all humanity. In his dawn blue eyes, the girl Messiah perceived all that she had never thought to desire. The first time that she saw the man, she tried to approach him, but found that many of her devotees stood between them awaiting her care. For a moment she didn't care, that is, wouldn't have been bothered to see them slaughtered, if only they weren't in her way. She attempted to push past the hordes, yet couldn't move a limb. She looked down. She couldn't even see her legs and arms, so fiercely were folks grasping them in want of her ministrations. Their troubles overwhelmed her. Their expectations overcame her. She yielded. Zion was a good girl. Did it matter that she hadn't asked to be the Messiah? Her followers hadn't asked to suffer. She returned to the marketplace the next day and the day after. Folks gathered around her with small aches and abrasions, but she couldn't find her peddler among them. She wanted to ask about him, wished she'd had his name. What did she say? She worked, and she waited. It was on the 4th day that news of Zion's father at last found her early morning in the marketplace. In the time that it took her to read the letter, 10 more came, and then 100, 1,000. Before the blizzard of paper could smother her, the fastest horse was fetched from the mayor's stables and saddled. A man lifted her up by the waist. In his grip, she felt a shimmer, like first light within her. She caught his dawn blue eyes, their blaze. His cheek brushed hers. He whispered some words in her. She couldn't be sure, but she thought he said, "I'm here for you, Zion." Then the horse carried her across a landscape smooth with fallen paper to the next town, where she changed to a fresh horse, and so forth, all the way home. The rabbi received her in an embrace and took her to Menashe. The apothecary hadn't been awake in days, the rabbi told her. He didn't drink or eat. His emaciated body rattled with death whenever he breathed. Zion mounted the stairs and entered his bedchamber alone. From the window, she saw that the whole town had gathered below. She turned away from them. She knelt on the floor beside Menasha's cot, and beneath the blankets found his hand. The nails were already long and sharp like a cadaver's subterranean claws, yet she didn't wince. So often had she done this before, going and back into the world for another day. She began chanting. She put her ear to his chest to hear her words hum within him. They didn't. Instead, there was a rumbling. Menasha, clearing his throat, coughing. Enough with the singing, Diane. Hush, Papa, it's good for you. This is how I save people. First you run away from home and make me old because I can't rely on you. Now I'm dying and you're telling me what to do. Won't die. I'm an apothecary. I know things. I'm the Messiah. Things are as I say. No, daughter, you're delusional. You're just an ordinary girl. I'm your father, Zion. I'm your father, Zion. I'd have noticed if you had the wings of an angel. I'd have seen if you had fallen from the heavens. But what about my miracles? Don't you recall what I told you about my medicines? Don't you remember how I said that they don't do anything on their own, but sometimes they work wonders just because people believe in them? Since the body is the best apothecary? Yes, Zion. Your miracles are like my elixirs. They're tricks of a charlatan. You're certain? As certain as you will be shortly when, in spite of your magical interventions, this sickness finally kills me. Find love, Zion. Make a family. Life is the only miracle, and it's brief. At least may I sing to you? Sing me a lullaby, child. As she chanted, he shut his eyes and hummed along. When she could no longer hear him, he was gone. In the realm of human experience, only watching your parents die is more terrible than seeing your Messiah cry. After many hours, Zion went to the window, bathed in tears, to share what had happened and what she now knew. My father is dead, she exclaimed. I am not the Messiah. Please, go home. But how could they possibly believe Zion? There was too much evidence against her blasphemous claims, evidence carried in their own bones. Were she not the Messiah? They wouldn't be there to be forsaken by her. Why would she save them from the demon plague, only to abandon them? What sin had they committed to bring her to tears? What evil had they done to make her take Menasha's life and leave them? They demanded that she at least condemn them, requested the small justice of knowing the crime for which they were punished. Zion came down to them. Even in her anguish, she recognized that the only sin had been her messianic arrogance, and that the atonement must be her silence. She would simply let folks believe about her what they had to believe. Her crime would become her punishment. A placebo messiah, the apothecary's orphan wandered the land. She no longer performed miracles, nor expected them, but rather watched, breathless, as they happened, seemingly spontaneously, wherever she went. In her presence, folks found health and wealth, wisdom even. Families ended feuds, and countries brought wars to truce. The miracles appeared more incredible than before, as if to test her, to taunt her, to torment her with the awareness she alone possessed, that she'd nothing whatsoever to do with the world and its mystery. Zion felt like a scapegoat, except her burden wasn't blame, but credit. She had to keep moving to escape the wrath of acclaim. She traveled in silence for a year, and witnessed every possible astonishment save for the one that might have moved her. The wonder of being embraced again by the man with eyes of dawn, whispered. She realized that he couldn't be there for her if she was everywhere and nowhere. A placebo human. Zion, false messiah, had become entirely what she was not, at the expense of who she was then. When miracles happened in her midst, she no longer knew who was being acclaimed. She felt neither pride nor shame. She lost all delusions, could neither see nor hear. The air gave way around her. Zion fainted. She'd been standing in a pasture. Folks set her on a bed of straw there. The villagers didn't know what to do, for they'd never seen a messiah before, much less one who was ill. The town had neither rabbi nor shul. The mayor sent his sons to the three nearest cities. Each returned leading a veritable country. Aldermen and holy men, tradesmen and peasants. If this was the apocalypse, who didn't want to be in the midst of it? The crush to see Zion on her cot was suffocating. She was barely breathing. She responded to nobody, nothing. Her eyes were open, unblinking. Her lips were parted, unmoving. Her skin, radiant white, began to bloom. Or so some claimed. Others insisted that the change came from up above, as the afternoon sky darkened overhead, enfolding Zion in deepest ultramarine. And the last light vanished under a fringe of fiery red. Zion was swept away in the light. She cast off her body like a slip as she was carried through the night. At last she came to rest. She knew not where, only that it was not a world she had traveled before. Still, she felt no fear. For she was in the grasp of something long wanted, cradling her, easing her to sleep. Sometime later, the dawn awoke her. She looked up into the blue eyes of her lost peddler. He wore a mantle woven of the sun's spectrum in which he held her. She heard herself speak. What are you doing here? Don't you know, Zion? I'm the Messiah. But you were a peddler before. Yeah, it was something to do. The world didn't need me while you were alive. I needed you. You have me now. You never leave me again. I'll leave you every day to cross the sky. At night, you'll be my bride. Holding her tight, he pierced her with light. Then he left to lead in the new morning. She watched as folks awoke and looked around, each finding that the apocalypse had not happened. One by one, they then gazed up into the dawn and smiled. It was well that a messiah passed above, now that Zion, their savior, had shown them how to live. Yeah, that was Zion the Profane, from the Book of the Unknown, Tales of the 36th, by Jonathan Keats. I don't have a lot of time to read another story. I've got one of my own done. Sorry. Dead airtime is one of the bad things, right? Okay. Well, there'll be advanced copies of my book out on Thursday, February 23rd. Lawrence Clark. here in also in beautiful downtown up in 6 o'clock. I'm trying to finish this other story. It's not in the book, so that I can read it there. If I can get it done, it'll be a real dinger, I promise. Sorry, I'm like far away from the mic. Okay, this is like a story that will never be published ever. It's called The Lotus Eater. The captain announced the temperature and the time and which pier to go to for other destinations. And the three of us got up and grabbed our bags and got off. We made our way to the train and found a map and paid the fare for our stop and got on and rode off. And we thought, because none of us knew anyone, we found a nearby cafe where no one talked, and the stereo was playing the boom, click, hiss of the needle stuck in the last groove of the vinyl, which none of the patrons seemed to mind. I felt uneasy to feel so at ease among strangers in a strange land full of strange, and I said so. And Jami said something like, yeah, or yup, and we found a bench and sat down. Raoul pointed at his uniform with a sweep of his hand, a motion with the air of a grand gesture in all that stillness, and said he was bathed in sweat but somehow didn't mind the heat the way he had at Navy Nagar in Mumbai. After an indeterminate wait where none of us spoke, I wordlessly headed for what looked like a bar and walked another stretch until an alabaster urchin greeted me with a lazy smile and a hi. That sounded like a sigh. Eventually, we got the goods and ate heartily of the blue paste that pollinated the blossom and didn't leave the room, itself a languid body with limbs that would have been bodies, whole persons, any place else. Even as it nourished you and mastered all concerns, save for fucking and sleeping and eating the ganj, an uninitiated wayfarer could judge the cost of this ecology too great. There are not only toddlers and teens amid what we learned in due course to be an entire commune of more than 1,000 compounds sprawling from one end of the lush island to the other, but people of all ages, sizes, colors, engaged in this apparently sedentary lifestyle, this easing as healthy, peaceful, forgiving, a way of life that struck us each as entirely feasible throughout the soon-to-be truncated time that I lived.